Okay, if you could take a seat, that would be great. Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and introduce our next speaker. When we were thinking about putting this together and structuring kind of the content, we really wanted to make sure that trauma was addressed, because trauma and stress are just such a, you know, when you think about Sean's presentation about this population being really overwhelmed, and stress and anxiety and trauma are really kind of mixed into that bag of feeling overwhelmed. The other one is depression. I've never really seen a generation that goes from "I'm having a bad day" to "I think I'd like to kill myself" faster than this generation. There's like very few speed bumps in the road that really slows them down in that thought process. And I really wanted to make sure that this topic was going to be addressed. So to do that, Jacqueline Yorkie, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist, who primarily works with clients who struggle with anxiety, depression, trauma, attachment injuries. Jacqueline also provides clinical supervision at SIFT. So SIFT, we hired Jacqueline 17 years ago. She was a child. And I actually had to convince Jim Masteller at the time. He's not here, so I can speak about this. I had to tell Jim, "No, I know she looks like a little baby, but she's really good. We need to hire her." And you never age. I don't know what kind of magic potion you take, but we love having her at SIFT. She's also an adjunct professor at... Are you still teaching at APU? Okay. Well, and she, like my wife and me, is a three-boy mother. And so if you can imagine how busy life is and career, we're just glad that she's here with us today. So if you could welcome Jacqueline Yorkie.
Thank you. I was like a baby when he hired me, and I was hoping he would tell that story, because I'm just glad they hired me so long ago. He already introduced me. I'm grateful for that. I've been seeing clients for 18 years. I'll tell you that my first client was suicidal, so I was kind of slammed into what is depression and how are we going to deal with this, and it was so anxiety-provoking. Some of that anxiety never stops when we're talking about depression. So complicated. It's a really difficult topic to engage. There's no way we're going to touch on everything we need to this morning. So I'm going to give an overview. And my main goal for my time with you guys was triage. Someone in your community is depressed. What do we do, right? What are we going to do with that? So we're going to go over some symptoms. What is depression? I'm going to sprinkle quotes throughout so that we can hear how it sounds in the minds of people who are depressed. I want to cover what you're going to see physically, what you're going to hear, what you're not going to hear. And then we're going to do, I think this is an interactive group, and so I'm pretty excited about that, because I want to actually work through a scenario with you where you have someone who is depressed in front of you, and what do you do and how do you manage how you feel about it? So I'm really happy everyone's here to talk about young adults in our community, and I think I'm going to fight with this mic the whole time, the mic and the paper. So I'm the generation that still prints things because I'm technologically challenged and I'm not going to catch up, probably. So bear with me if I'm throwing papers around. That's just going to be what it is, and we can laugh about it because we're talking about depression. So we'll find like some bright spots. We have to laugh or we'll cry. That's like honestly the reality of talking about depression. So I thought this would be such a great opportunity to be with all of you guys so we could have a peek behind the curtain of what therapists have when we have clients in our room and what we usually can't have, which is contact with you that we wish we could have because we don't have releases of information. So I like today. It's my chance to say, hey, if I could tell you anything I think you need to know, here it is. And my goal is for you to walk out of here saying, I think I can remember one thing that I can do that'll make a difference. And I was shocked when I was at when I was in graduate school, because I heard a story of a young man who was very depressed, and he was taking antidepressants and had a lot of guilt about that. And he went and he talked to his pastor, and his pastor said, "You're not trusting God enough because you're taking antidepressants." I think you guys know how bad this is going to turn out. He goes home and he's so upset by this thought that he's not trusting God enough that he quits his antidepressants and ends up killing himself. That wasn't the goal of the pastor. He probably had some intention of how do we get you closer to the Lord, but the thing that was said didn't work, and it hurt. And it hurt him, and it didn't go well. And we're here to not have that happen to, with you and anybody that you know in your entire life, whether it's your sphere of influence at church or your sphere of influence at home and anywhere in between. So I'm going to start with some quotes. I like that Holly kicked us off with a close your eyes experience. So if you feel comfortable with that, I welcome you to close your eyes so that you can just try to take in, this is how depressed people feel. This is what some brave people have said so that we can understand their experience, which I love because I can't tell you what my clients say. So I'm going to borrow from people who have been willing to say it publicly. So the first quote, depression is feeling like you've lost something, but having no clue when or where you last had it. Then one day you realize what you lost is yourself. The sun, this is from a woman named Nina LaCour. The sun stopped shining for me is all. The whole story is I am sad. I am sad all the time, and the sadness is so heavy that I can't get away from it, not ever. Elizabeth Wurtzel said, that's the thing about depression. A human being can survive almost anything as long as she sees the end in sight. But depression is so insidious and it compounds daily that it's impossible to ever see the end. This next quote was Dan Reynolds. People who have never dealt with depression think it's just being sad or being in a bad mood. That's not what depression is for me. It's falling into a state of grayness and numbness. Sophia Turner said, I would cry and cry and cry just to have to change and put on clothes. I said, I can't do this. I can't go outside. I have nothing that I want to do. Lily Singh said, a big part of depression is feeling really lonely, even if you're in a room full of a million people. Elizabeth Gilbert said, depression on my left, loneliness on my right. They don't need to show me their badges. I know these guys very well. And then Tupac Shakur, kind of aging me right there probably. Behind every sweet smile, there is a bitter sadness that no one can ever see and feel. So what is depression? And I'm going to see if I can... It worked. Okay. What is depression? I hear we have students in the room, so if they want to volunteer to give us the DSM criteria, we could jump right in it. I heard there's a table in the front. I won't put you on the spot, no. Okay, so depression is this. It's a mood disorder that negatively impacts the way you think, feel, act, and perceive the world around you. It causes a persistent feeling of sadness and a loss of interest or pleasure in activities that were once meaningful to you. I'm going to add, and it's not on the slide, there's a difference between sadness and depression, and that this is sadness that is ongoing. It's not, I'm sad today, today was a bad day. You might have a mild feeling of depression for a day, and it leaves. True depression, separate from just sadness, is it's going to continue, and you don't know what to do about it. It can even cause extreme feelings of despair and hopelessness that leads to the belief that death may be the only viable escape from overwhelming sadness. So we'll look at common symptoms of depression: low energy, fatigue, sleep disturbances, agitation, irritability, difficulty making decisions, poor concentration, low self-esteem, hopelessness, loneliness, feelings of despair, feelings of worthlessness, isolation from others, lack of motivation, lack of engagement and lack of meaning and purpose. We're going to talk, none of these are exhaustive lists, by the way. I'm trying to capture it in a nutshell for you guys. These lists could include so much more. So I want to talk also about causes of depression. I really want to say you don't need to know what's causing someone's depression to be with them. So even though I'm going to cover these so you have a general overview of what our young people today might be struggling with that's influencing this, you don't have to get it. You don't have to get why they're depressed in order to show up for them. But these might be some suggestions for you to consider in your mind. School-related stress and burnout, worry about family members, ruptures and changes in friendships. They may be asking themselves, who are my friends? Fluctuating hormones we know can play a role. Unresolvable stress, and what I would like to, as an example, offer you about unresolvable stress is poverty. So if someone is living in poverty, they are chronically stressed, even if they're not talking about it. Guilt, chronic illness, trauma, loss of a loved one, abuse, sexual identity issues, sports conflicts and changes, and let me add disappointments, maybe loss of the sports dream that you were hoping to have, disagreement with parents, anxiety about the future. The question is, what is my future? I would like to emphasize this. I have very depressed young adults who this is almost every week the thing they're saying to me is, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I don't know what my future holds. I can't figure it out, and I don't even know how to figure it, like get the steps to try to figure it out. That's lost on them. And experiencing racism, a couple questions in addition to the ones that I mentioned here that would be on their minds are, am I developing enough? So comparing with their peers. And the question of, where do I fit in? It's really hard to be a young adult. And actually, what I want to say about the age category I had in mind when I was preparing this for you is as young as 10, which may sound crazy because that's still a child, but we know the age of adolescence begins at 10 and ends at 25. So we're on the journey starting at 10, and therefore it's relevant. If we're talking about young adults, we're talking about a lot of different ages and sizes and people going through puberty all at the same time and things like that. So I'm gonna alarm us a little bit, and I want to apologize, and at the same time I want to say this is the stuff I think we have to know. And if it scares us a little, that's okay. There is hope, and knowing these things will perpetuate hope because it helps us change how we deal with them. So these are the statistics. A lot of them were longitudinal studies, so they lasted for a really long time, and we can glean what we can from them. The first one, extremely alarming. There was a 144% increase in suicides, completed suicides, not attempts, among Black youth ages 10 to 17 from the years 2007 to 2020. Before I go into these next ones, I think it has been mentioned and said already, depression and anxiety tend to go hand in hand. You typically have both present. It's not always true, but it's often true. So we're going to include some statistics about anxiety here. Both depression and anxiety saw an increase of 63% in prevalence among young adults from the years 2005 to 2017. There was a 60% increase in depression from the years 2017 to 2021. A 31% increase in anxiety between the years of 2017 and 2021. I'll just pause here to say, COVID hit us during that time, and all the therapists who are practicing in the room right now can tell you that if we'd been in this for a really long time, which I had, I've never seen so many suicidal young adults in my entire career as when they were forced to be isolated. So the power of social connection was really relevant and lost at that time, and we haven't fully recovered, and you're going to see that with more of the trends with depression. Suicide deaths among 10 to 24-year-olds increased by 62% from 2007 to 2021. This really alarmed me. It cuts off at 2022, but they're projecting this just kept growing. that the research said there was an 8.2% annual increase in suicides from 2008 to 2022 in preteens and children as young as 8. Pretty alarming. Why are 8-year-olds even knowing about the concept of dying and death and that being relevant for them some way? In 2023, half of young adults reported symptoms of depression, having symptoms of depression and anxiety. Suicide is currently the second leading cause of death for teens and young adults ages 10 to 24. 1 in 5 high school students seriously considered attempting suicide in 2023. So if I can do math up here on the spot, you have a 20-person class, that meant 4 students at any given time were contemplating ending their life. That's alarming. I don't know about you. I didn't grow up with 4 people in my class considering killing themselves. And what we know now, which is a change in the pattern, is now young adults have higher rates of depression than older adults. So that's a change. It's quite alarming. And we have to know this because we have to take it seriously. And the more we know about it, the more we can get our minds around it and see what we can do with this to help people. So here's what you're physically going to see. I wanted to bring this down to the most practical level. If you're at church, if you're at youth group, if you're hosting something in your home and you have young adults, this is how you might see them present themselves. Downcast expression. So I did a lot of the Gottman Institute's training, and I'm not sure if anybody in here knows who they are. They're really well known for their work with couples and designing a theory around to help people, and they've done a lot of research. And so in one of the later trainings in that program, they discussed micro expressions. Has anybody heard about micro expressions? There are very obvious expressions. My table in the back are my supervisees that I've had. They've heard me say this too many times, probably. Obvious facial expressions would be like a really big frown and just like sitting there, eyes closed maybe, and you'd go, oh, they really look depressed. Micro expressions are fleeting on the face. I can't exactly remember, but it's less than 2 seconds that it's on the face and it's gone. So if you don't catch it, you missed it, but they are there. And sometimes intuitively, even if we didn't register it, we saw it and we're like, something feels off. So a downcast expression, what they showed us in photo form, is it's a downturning of the outer edges of the eyes and the outer edges of the lips. And it's just really quick, and that's the micro expression of depression. So if you think you ever see that, you could just note like, I think that's what she was talking about. Something in their face, their countenance shifted down, and then it left. Like maybe they knew they were experiencing that and it shifted away. Lack of eye contact is a number one. Every single client I've seen and currently see that is depressed are looking down to the left all the time. They'll check in to see, am I there with them? But they are not looking me in the eye for the majority of our session time. And so you might experience that too, where you're talking to someone and they're just looking anywhere but at you. And that's their way to tolerate what's going on for them. They may be sitting alone and avoiding others, which is, I want to also add, isn't a guaranteed sign of being depressed, but it could be an indicator that they don't know how to fit in and they're having a really hard time being somewhere. A look of complete exhaustion, giving away belongings like special jewelry or sports memorabilia. If you're hearing things like, yeah, so-and-so gave me their special necklace, and you're thinking, that doesn't sound right. Probably it's not, and that would be a more serious thing to take note of because maybe they're giving things away because they're planning to hurt themselves. Choosing not to participate in activities, having difficulty going places, and having what would appear to be a lack of care about their appearance, not clean clothes, never doing their hair. Younger kids these days also have different hairstyles, so I will admit that this may be a little bit challenging because their hair just looks undone a lot. So don't hold me to that one for this current season that we're in about hair care. But they would just look like, hey, have they showered? They kind of smell. They don't look like they're even trying. Is this a sign that they're not well because they don't look well to me? And so these are things you may see that might clue you in. Hey, something's going on here. Something's not quite right. So things that you will hear. They all popped up at once. Perfect. I want to just say silence. You might hear nothing, which is also part of my next slide of what you won't hear. But I want to emphasize up front that depressed people aren't going to come tell you they're depressed, most likely, unless it's for some reason they know you, they have a good relationship with you, then they might say these things to you. But more often than not, depressed people are not really using words. They're too depressed to find language to tell you about it. But if they can speak, this is most often the things you will hear them say. I'm just not myself lately. I feel sad a lot. I don't know why I'm crying all the time. I just am. Death would be a relief. I wish I could just disappear. I'm just angry all the time. I can't think clearly. I'm unlovable. Sometimes I wish I just wouldn't wake up in the morning. There's no point in living anymore. And then I'm fine. And I'm going to read you a quote by Gail Honeyman about what fine is for you guys to know. She said, if someone asks you how you are meant to say fine. You are not meant to say that you cried yourself to sleep last night because you hadn't spoken to another person in two consecutive days. Fine is what you say. So if you're seeing someone, all the things we talked about, how they may look, and you say, hey, how are you? And they say, I'm fine. Remember this quote that they may not be fine at all, and to trust your gut instinct that what you're seeing in them is a very real thing that's going on, and maybe they can't tell you about it yet. All right. Things you won't hear. I'm a burden to others. I'm going to read you. Everyone knows who Michael Phelps is, right? So I don't know if you know much about his journey with depression, but this is what he said about feeling like a burden. I felt like I didn't want to be alive anymore. And I felt for me that I was causing a lot of stress and issues for other people around me. So I thought the best thing for me to do was just leave. This is what people who are depressed don't tell you most oftentimes, is that they feel like such a burden being sad all the time and that you have to care about their sadness. But it'd be better if they just weren't here, because then you wouldn't be burdened by them anymore. Also, they carry around inside them, I can't look weak. I was talking to a client about this, like, I can't fail. I can't get it wrong. I have to succeed. Such intensity about it, but they're not really talking about that with others. They're afraid of disappointing people. I think people hate me or think I'm weird. My future is hopeless. I'm drinking and doing drugs to make these feelings go away. And cutting feels like it helps me feel something. These are things they're not going to want to say. So in order to try to help others, I want to start with all of us, including myself here. And we're going to start with how you might feel. If you're talking to someone or seeing someone who's depressed, maybe you know part of their story. First and foremost, you might feel anxious. I want to let you in on a secret, I suppose, that therapists who are well-trained have done this for a really long time, have seen a lot of suicidal clients, this is me and a lot of other people in this room, still get anxious when someone tells us this. And the anxiety is not a bad thing, it's just a human reaction to something serious is happening right now, and I care about it. And so I'm nervous about what I'm supposed to do next. So you can even feel frozen. I love that Holly went over fight, flight, freeze. This is part of that. You can feel scared and terrified. You can feel hopeless and uncertain. And so I geek out on neuroscience. And so we're going to drop in a little neuroscience onto why you might feel all the feelings you feel around a depressed person. And there's a thing called mirror neurons. Anybody already know what mirror neurons are? We've got some people. Great. So when we observe, this is the job of mirror neurons, when we observe someone experiencing an emotion, it activates mirror neurons in our brain to simulate the same action and emotional state inside of us. So just like a mirror, you're around someone who's got a lot of joy and happiness, you're around them, the mirror neurons in your brain are going, woo, we're happy, we're doing good, we're feeling a little good. And likewise, if you're around someone who's really, really low and depressed or anxious, you're going to notice that you're starting to feel these feelings you didn't start the day with, and all of a sudden something's happening to you. This is just a sign your brain is doing something it's designed to do, with the mirror neurons mimicking what it's seeing in front of you. Us therapists use that. We go, oh, we feel something going on here. We wonder what this is and try and talk about it. And you might do the same. And then I want to talk about compassion fatigue. So this is fatigue that's experienced as a result of exposure to traumatic stories over time that can take on the appearance of PTSD. It can lead to the same feelings of depression being experienced in the people that you are attempting to help. So if for some reason in your sphere of influence, you're having a lot of time spent with people who are depressed, you will notice you begin to feel this fatigue and burnout. And the remedy for this is self-care. And so I just want to throw out your way a few ideas about self-care. Exercise, healthy and regular eating habits. That's usually the first thing that goes out the door, is eating with intentionality and making sure you actually did in a day. Getting enough sleep, getting outdoors, hobbies, spending time with friends and loved ones, praying, connecting with God. I'm going to deviate from my notes and just say that the number one thing that I tell clients in distress to do with regularity is go outside on a walk. And the reason why is there is compelling research that has been coming out about being on a walk and observing trees, calming down the instinct in our brain for amygdala's fight, flight, and freeze response. It naturally does it for you. All you have to do is go outside and be on a walk. Same is true for being around mountains and ocean air. It does the same thing to the brain. It causes peace to come over it. It helps it settle it down without you doing anything but moving your body outside. So some of my clients get reminded of that almost every week. And when they start doing it, they notice it, that they're coping better. It's such a reliable coping skill. So that might be a good coping skill for you as well. All right. So we're going to transition into how do we help. And I'm going to talk a little, and then we're going to go through a scenario and have some audience participation. We're going to go through it together. So I have a Dwayne Johnson quote, which I'm pretty sure everyone knows who The Rock is. In our house, he's really famous because of Moana. Yes. Uh-huh. We love The Rock. He's fantastic. We know all of his songs, every single word of them, because that's my life with all boys right now. Okay, so he said, and I don't even know if you knew he knows about depression. He said, I found that with depression, one of the most important things you could realize is that you're not alone. So we're going to use that as our guidepost in talking about how to help and not leaving people alone who are feeling depressed. Did I change it? Okay. The first one is take a deep breath. You're not surprised because my last one was all about how to take care of you first. This is just to regulate yourself. Depression is hard. It's hard to sit with because it's so painful. And if we're really with people who are depressed, we're going to feel it. And we're going to have all kinds of reactions of sympathy and empathy, compassion for people. And so, and we might be scared too, right? Because we don't know if we are going to say and do the right things. So if you're with someone, maybe it's not a very obvious deep breath, but it just might be, hey, I should make sure I'm breathing and not holding my breath. Let's start there. If for some reason you're not sitting in front of someone at that moment, I'd like to tell you what a physiological sigh is. Is anyone familiar with Andrew Huberman's podcast? He puts out incredible research. It's incredible. I highly recommend. I haven't listened to all of them, so I recommend a lot of them, maybe not all of them. I'm not sure. But he talks about the physiological sigh. So the physiological sigh forces your body to deal with stress and reduce it. So how this looks is a 4-second, it's very specific, a 4-second inhale through your nose and a 6-second exhale through your mouth. And the reason they do that is, you're supposed to do that, is it puts compression on your heart even when you exhale for that long and forces it to calm down, which is pretty cool. Now, you probably can't do that if you're sitting face to face with someone in the moment, but if you're noticing, hey, this is really stressing me out, this is one way you can help your body cope. And then the next two things are probably the most important things I want you to walk out of here with today. So if nothing else, if you remember that I said something about attunement and, more importantly, empathy, then we have won today and we've accomplished what we wanted. So I want to define attunement to you first. It's the ability to be aware of and responsive to another person's emotions. This is like having a sense. I have a sense that they're kind of low right now. You might understand it. You're going to match them without words. So when you see someone who's excited and their eyebrows are raised and their vocal pitch is higher and they're speaking a little faster because they're so excited, how I'm doing it right now is how you would match them back if this is how they're being. That's called attunement. If they came with all this excitement and I was just like, all right, cool, I'd be misattuned. So if someone is depressed and I'm talking with a lot of excitement at them, I am misattuned and we're not going to line up very well for me to be able to help them. Empathy is the ability, and we heard Holly talk about this also, so I'm just going to restate it. It's the ability to understand and share the other person's feelings. This would be like, I'm feeling deeply with you right now. I do want to tell you that understanding, having empathy is not agreement. So they may tell you things where you think, I don't agree with what they're saying. For example, if someone really depressed is confiding in you, drinking is the only way I can cope with how I feel, you're not going to agree that this is the best coping mechanism for them. You're also not going to tell them that you don't agree. And it's not really that important up front to have that opinion if you're just trying to connect and help them. Empathy is, oh my gosh, it's been so hard that that's the only way you know how to cope right now. Gosh, that's really tough. That's empathy. It's not agreement. It's just being with. Also, the reason why empathy is so powerful, and I'm going to probably not get all the language correct here, so hang in with me. I want to tell you one of my favorite things I know about empathy to be true that researchers studied. They saw it happen. And so what happens is they would hook people up to these monitors. These were neuroscientists. And they would monitor what was happening in their brain while they were having a conversation with each other. And this might be familiar to some of you. So what they noticed, if someone was sharing something really difficult for them, the right hemisphere of their brain lit up. It's not altogether surprising. We know this is our emotion wheelhouse on the right hemisphere. So they would notice right hemisphere is lighting up, right? They send the information to the other person about what they're suffering and struggling with, some pain that they're carrying. If the person gave an empathic response back to them, here's what they saw. The right hemisphere in their brain was also lighting up. And then the more important thing they saw was that, forgive me on errors right here, that the synapses and the dendrites and the neural pathways that in the brain had looked like they had sort of shriveled up and maybe died off were coming back to life. And then they said, this is powerful. This is the right brain to right brain connection. When empathy comes back and we have this moment, the brain and the person who sent the information of pain to the other person physically changes. There is a healing that takes place in their brain. This is why empathy is the, if you remember nothing else I said and you're like, empathy, that's what I'm going to give to the world around me. We're going to succeed here because you can literally change how a person's brain is functioning when you are offering them pure empathy. So in terms of support, you can offer support. It can look as simple as, how can I help you? How can I come alongside you? You could come up with suggestions because you may know the person that you're talking to really well. So then yours would be tailor-made for them because you know them. I would say this is a little bit of a challenge, the next one on here, remaining understanding, patient, and encouraging. If anybody in here has known someone really well who's been depressed for a very long time, you will know that patience is a requirement to show up in their life because you're not going to get a whole lot back from them. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more and some other things I'm going to say, but this is, it's an important part of this. Keeping things really simple and practical. You don't have to have fancy language when you're talking to someone who's feeling depressed. You don't have to have really big or grand ideas for how to help them or come alongside them. It could be as simple as inviting them outside to go on a walk. And now none of you are shocked that I include this because we know how it helps the human brain. Or an activity, because you may know something about them that they love to do outside or inside, I suppose, like grabbing coffee, and you could invite them out. The key thing I would recommend here is to say, you know, we could go for a walk even in silence. Even if you don't want to tell me how hard it's been, I'm here. I'm here. I'm here to listen, and I'm here to be silent and just with you if that's what you need. And then I would also say to ask yourself, have you ever been depressed? Do you know about it? Is it something you're familiar with? If so, sharing your personal experience of life with depression or how you learned to cope with it or how you got help can be really helpful for someone who is currently suffering with depression. It offers them hope. It can destigmatize it. A lot of times people don't share because they're afraid of what people might think of them if they knew how bad they were feeling. So if you've had an experience and you're comfortable and you're talking to them and it's relevant, sharing is really important. All right, so I'm going to move us into a scenario, and I would like some participation because what I wanted to do is give something really practical. Like, this is what might walk in your door. Let's talk about it together so that you actually have some steps in mind of here's what I can do. This is not going to be up here. Sorry about that. Okay, so I'm going to read it to you, and then I'll start asking for your feedback right away. A 22-year-old college student named Alex. This is fake. This is not a client of mine, by the way. This is Google's assistance, and then I embellished it because confidentiality. A 22-year-old student named Alex, who was once outgoing and actively involved in church life, starts missing church, services, and activities. He starts withdrawing from friends, is crying often, tells his mom he feels sad every day, is neglecting his studies, and consistently feeling overwhelmed by life. He sleeps excessively, has lost interest in his favorite hobby, pickleball, which he used to play daily, and has expressed feelings of worthlessness despite having a generally supportive network of family and friends. His mom has convinced him to come and meet up with you. He avoids eye contact with you, lets her do all the talking, is slumped over, and looks disheveled and exhausted. You don't have to raise your hand. What did you hear that sounded like depression? Just to get you guys thinking about it. Like, it was this. What did you guys hear? How do we know he's depressed? What did he show us and what did we hear? Crying. I couldn't hear. I didn't hear. Withdrawing. Thank you. Disheveled. I missed someone said something and I heard something else. Lack of eye contact. Yes. Yeah, that was an important one. Social support system, but not engaging in it. Yep. Yeah. Lost interest in hobbies that were once favorites. Anything else? Disheveled. Yeah. Okay. Did I hear something else? Sleeping a lot. Yes. Yep. Okay. So the question is, what can you do? We're going full participation on the whole thing. What do you think is first? What's your first move? Pray. Okay, so coping skills. You're like, start praying in my mind right now. How am I going to respond to this? That right there was the honest anxiety, right? Like, woo, God, we're going to need some help right here. Okay, so pray first. Love that. Yeah. A kind touch. Yeah, that could be a way to demonstrate some warmth. Okay. Yeah, what else? Okay, I love this. She said, for those of you who couldn't hear, is mom in the room? Get her out. Sometimes, yes, that's really the right move. I know. And other times, maybe not. So maybe we're gauging this. Maybe we know something about Alex and his mom and she needs to go, or maybe we need her there. Yeah. Okay. All right. So what he said was having attunement, trying to join him in his experience, which is actually my first point. I liked what everyone else said first also. But I I wrote slow and low, and I feel like that could be said backwards, low and slow. I don't know. But the point is attunement would be matching him. He's not looking at you. His posture is really down. He's not making eye contact or speaking. He's letting his mom do this. So attunement is step one, and that's what he's highlighting. Slow it down. Stay right where he's at. Don't get excitable. Don't get ahead of this. Just be right here. We're going to use our body, our voice, our posture, everything to be attuned. So our next step, does anyone want to take a guess at what I'm going to say is our next thing we're going to do? I feel like you have one. Empathy. She was listening. Okay. I love it. I have a whole list of empathic statements that I'm going to call your back pocket reliable statements, where pick one. If one of these you're like, I could say that the rest of my life, that's a good back pocket statement for me, go ahead and write it down. These are all ways that you can present empathy to another person. So I'm going to read them to you. It sounds like, I'm going to try and be attuned in how I say this and not all excitable like I'm being. All right. It sounds like it's been a really challenging time for you lately. I can see that you've been going through a lot lately. The sadness you must feel isn't easy to put into words. I can't imagine how hard this has been for you. I can feel how heavy this is. This sounds really hard. I'm so glad you opened up to me so I can hold this with you. I hear you and I believe you when you say things have been really hard. The next step, another practical step, does anyone want to take a guess at what I would maybe suggest we could do next? Or what you think would feel good next after our empathy? What? Support. Thank you. I wish everyone had a microphone. Thank you. Support. Yeah, the next step is offering support. So I wrote down some phrases you can also hold in mind that could probably be used again and again. First one being the most obvious. How can I support you right now? If you don't want to talk, it's okay. I'll just sit with you. I'm here for you. I know a lot of people don't get it, but I'm here to listen. Even if I can't fix things for you, I'm here. Thank you for trusting me and sharing this with me. I care to hear more about this if you want to share. This one might be a stretch for some. I'm going to say it anyways. Mondays and Wednesdays, I have some free time throughout the day. Would you like to grab a coffee and go for a walk? And then if it's relevant, if you've had your own depression that you've experienced in one way or another, honestly, I've experienced depression myself. I know how hard it can be to feel so alone in it. Therapy really helped me. Would you like me to share the contact info of some therapists I trust who might be able to help you? Okay, and then after that, what I have is there would be some follow-up contact, which I didn't exactly address on that slide. This can mean a lot to people. Follow-up contact after maybe you've had all these moments with them, these kinds of things being said, a conversation, would be a text message letting them know, I remember you, I'm thinking about you, how have you been, a phone call, and an email. And what I want to say is to point back to the need for patience, because when people are really depressed, they don't respond. So you might be sending them 100 text messages before they ever even think that they're going to respond back to you. It's like the quotes we heard. It was like crying and crying, and I have to get dressed. Like they're not even doing the basic functions in life very well. So trying to text someone back is going to be a little too overwhelming for them. Just because they don't respond doesn't mean it's not helping. And that's what I want you to hold on to. They could ignore all the things you send, and at some point in time you might think, well, I don't want to be overdoing it or intrusive, but for a time, it's okay to keep checking and just know you might not hear back. Most likely, you won't hear back, or you might see them and they're not going to mention that they saw your text or something like that. That would be normal. And you can always be offering days and times you're free, whether or not they respond to that too. So it's just a reminder. I'm holding you in mind. I haven't forgotten about you. I haven't forgotten that you're struggling. So let's figure out what to do if they say something really alarming, though. So let's say Alex is saying some things, and he says, the truth is I wish I didn't wake up every morning. It'd be better if I wasn't here. What do you think is the next move? Could someone say that for me? Empathy. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You would ask them outright. I'm thankful that you brought this up because a lot of times people are too scared to ask that question. And the reason they're too scared to ask, hey, are you feeling like killing yourself? Is they're worried, will I give you that idea? If I ask if you're suicidal and you weren't, am I going to all of a sudden give you a brilliant idea to be suicidal? It doesn't work that way, actually. So just so you know, asking is better than not asking. And if they're suicidal or they're going to be, it's going to happen whether or not you've asked them the question about it. So start with empathy is exactly where I would start too. And I would say something like, and let's remember if they've now said these things that make you really afraid that they might hurt themselves, that your anxiety might drive back up. So it's just calm and simple. You're going to try and tell yourself, just take a deep breath. I've got this. Empathy leads the way. It's been so hard for you that you don't even want to wake up some days. That's the response when someone says, I wish I didn't wake up every day. That's what you say. You just remain calm and you say it. You take your own deep breaths. You breathing and regulating will probably cause them to breathe and regulate because of those same mirror neurons that we already talked about. And then you can be curious. Can you tell me more about that? Can you fill me in on what that's like every day for you that you wish you didn't wake up? Curiosity, compassionate curiosity just leads the way when someone is suffering like this. Then you can say, because you're naturally going to be really worried about them, and when someone's depression is this far that they don't want to be alive anymore, we need professionals to be involved. So you might say, I hate to hear that you're suffering this way. Can I help you find a therapist who can help you with this? You can brainstorm ideas with them about how we can come together to get you the support you need. And then if it's even more serious, I feel like I just need to address this because I know it comes up where people are like, I'm going to do it. That's it for me. Like this, I'm just out. I'm out of this life. It's not working. And you're like, oh no, they actually really mean what they're saying. This isn't just a passive thought. We call it passive suicidality when it's thoughts that come and go. They've moved into active territory. Number one, do not leave them alone. Stay right where you were when they said it to you. Take some deep breaths and go, okay, can't leave them here by themselves and I'm not going to let them out of my eyesight. That's not going to happen. And if you need to, you can call 911. You can call a helpline. I have some that I'm going to show you on the next screen. Pretty sure it's the next screen. And you can even see if anyone else is around so that you're not the only one trying to help them in this moment. If there's another trusted individual where you could say, hey, I just need you to be with us right now. That might help you stay a little regulated. The other person might be able to be the one to make the call or tend to the person who's really dysregulated and upset and feeling this way. Before I say my final thoughts, what I want to tell you about is there's resources. Obviously, there's SIFT Counseling Center, Holly Morris, therapists you may know about. There's also the National Alliance of Mental Illness Helpline that can be called. There's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. There's a Christian Teen Helpline. All of these things would be helpful if you found yourself with someone who's depressed, maybe having suicidal thoughts. There's the California Youth Crisis Line. And what I forgot to put on the slide that I'm glad I remembered late last night, thinking about being with you guys, is the With Hope Foundation. Does anybody know what I'm talking about, the With Hope Foundation? So you know it's amazing. So the With Hope Foundation was started by a woman whose daughter had committed suicide and had been in therapy, and they were doing everything they could to help her, and it just wasn't working. And so out of her pain and suffering, she created the With Hope Foundation, where what they do is they raise a lot of funds and they give those funds away to get you treatment. So if you don't have the means to pay for therapy, because therapy is costly, getting psychiatric care is costly. Some people have insurance for it, some people don't. The With Hope Foundation is there so that no minor is left outside of therapy. Everyone can have a place. They pay for therapy, they pay for psychiatric services. It's incredibly generous. People get the real help they need for a long time. If they can't afford it on their own, the With Hope Foundation is a place where they can apply to get the grant money to cover their care. All right, so my final thoughts for you is if we're envisioning life and you're trying to think about being with people who are depressed, and life is like this garden and there's benches all throughout the garden, sometimes in life there's a bench of depression, and everyone's going to have some feeling of depression in their life, and they're going to end up sitting on this bench. So if you have this visual in mind and you think, someone I know is depressed that I have influence and I can help, the best thing you might do is just sitting on the bench next to them. That's your attunement. Remember about empathy. It can feel really hopeless, but don't give up. There is truly always hope, and sometimes it just takes a while. So I'll finish this up with a quote. This is by someone named Shannon Adler. Thought it was great. Never give up on someone with a mental illness. When I is replaced by we, illness becomes wellness.